Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, March 15th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, National Weather Service, Fire Weather is Extreme. Midland's rainfall is more than 6 inches below average amount. By Stuart Doreen. It's dry in Midland. How dry? Well, the National Weather Service reports that since August, there has been 1.3 inches of precipitation fall at Midland International Airport. The average rainfall for that 7.5-month period is 7.42 inches. That means Midland's rainfall, including during a typically rainy season, August through October, is more than 6 inches below average. And it's not going to get any better anytime soon, according to the National Weather Service. The NWS shows no rain in the next 7-day forecast. The Climate Prediction Center showed on its website that the forecast through May calls for a 40 to 50% chance of below average rainfall. That means the region's exceptional drought conditions will not get any better. The U.S. Drought Monitor shows that conditions in the area that includes Midland-Odessa are the worst on its scale for intensity and impact. The U.S. Monthly Drought Outlook calls for drought conditions to persist. That forecast is consistent with the U.S. Seasonal Drought Outlook. The pattern that we have over the region calls for many warm, windy, and dry days through this week, said Matt Salerno, a forecaster in the National Weather Service's Midland office. We are not expecting any precipitation in the near term. Salerno said the region has been plagued by most storm systems passing to the north. The La Niña weather pattern helps shoot systems eastward once they reach the Rocky Mountains. This makes it next to impossible for a region already behind on precipitation to catch up. What also hurts from having the driest fall on record, 0.16 of an inch from September through November, and the fifth driest winter, 0.3 of an inch from December through January, is there is no moisture in the ground. The lack of moisture, according to Salerno, means the air dries out and dew points drop. In other words, the higher the dew point rises, the greater amount of moisture in the area, according to the NWS. Salerno said when dew points drop, dry lines are pushed east. He also said one of the only forms of relief is for an area of low pressure to move to the area to help pull moisture from the Gulf of Mexico. We are not seeing that pattern, Salerno said. Long-range models, he said, show dew points close to zero and the dry air remaining in place for at least the next 7 to 10 days. Toward the end of March, we might see a return to a slightly wetter pattern, Salerno said. Until then, the National Weather Service is concerned about potential fire weather potential. Fire weather danger is extreme right now, Salerno said. This article is entitled, Peyton Wants to Finish What He Started. Mayor makes announcement for second bid to work on Vision of Midland, by Stuart Doreen. It would be hard to blame Patrick Peyton if he feels like he was cheated out of 2 years of being mayor. He campaigned in 2019 with the hopes of leading a community that was growing at a blistering pace. Midland was on the rise, growing at a rate of 2.5 to 3%. Apartment rates were among the highest in the state. There was a lot to take care of. Less than 5 meetings into his first term, COVID happened, essentially cutting the legs from under his to-do list. The price of oil dropped into negative territory, and decisions about development took a back seat to being a protector of business, good governance, and a way of life many in West Texas had known. I am very grateful Patrick was our mayor with everything we have experienced, said Peyton's former Stonegate Fellowship colleague Mike Goak, who said a prayer and introduced the mayor Monday. Goak joked that when Peyton decided to run for mayor the first time, the consensus was, "That is awesome. We need him." And when Peyton said he decided to run for a second term, the consensus was, "That guy is nuts." COVID was enough to rock the most seasoned politician. Peyton, one of the most effective communicators in the city, still wants to finish what he started. That is what he announced Monday at the Second Story co-working. Peyton talked about the tens of millions of dollars that have and will be invested into city parks. He talked about Midland becoming a destination location for people traveling for softball and soccer tournaments, maybe even the occasional cricket match. He said it was time to finish what the councils of the past and present have done to support Midland firefighters and police officers. He said roads and infrastructure will remain a priority. Peyton also said part of his vision is the creation of a Midland City Hall that will be known as the Chick-fil-A of City Halls, where developers and those doing business with the City of Midland won't find red tape or roadblocks. "We'll just find a way to do it," Peyton said. "And you say, 'My pleasure,' rather than 'Your fault.' And so we'll keep working on those issues. We really do believe in Midland, Texas." Peyton said he sees the transformation of Midland with a younger generation signing up for boards and commissions. The same thing is true of a Midland City Council that is younger and less experienced than any in recent memory. That doesn't faze Peyton. He said Monday he will happily run against whoever is running against us. Those running against Peyton will have to show a grand vision to compete against the current mayor, who once talked about unlocking the resources above ground to match Midland's greatness below ground, and of Midland becoming a top 100 city. Monday, he talked about how the city of Midland, in partnership with private business, is on the cusp of historical achievements when it comes to the handling of produced water. "If some things happen that we think might happen, it will literally make history when it comes to water," Peyton said. "There's some amazing things that can happen when our water resources are good for the next 75 to 100 years. But some things are happening related to the oil field that will be historical for the globe." Peyton said he will continue to be a mayor that works with other energy city leaders. He said he looks forward to partnering with State Senator-elect Kevin Sparks to bring down and maybe even eliminate property taxes. He also said he agrees with Congressman August Pfluger, who believes a well-placed call to the mayor of Midland should matter more to guaranteeing energy resources than a call to a leader of a country like Venezuela. "There are so many things that we can continue to do," Peyton said. This article is entitled, "Trichetti Seeks Re-Election to MISD. School Board Member Commits to Not Run Again for Office in 26," by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD School Board Member John Trichetti III will run for re-election. Trichetti is the board member for District 5. Currently, that district includes areas around Santa Rita Elementary, Emerson Elementary, San Jacinto Junior High, Goddard Junior High, Early College High School at Midland College, and the growing State Highway 349 corridor in Northeast Midland. Trichetti is seeking his second term on the board, and in an announcement about his intention to run, the executive director of the Literacy Coalition of the Permian Basin said he will not seek another term on MISD's school board in 2026. "I am looking forward to continuing serving the community, and in an area I am passionate. Literacy and education," Trichetti wrote. "The cultivation of new leaders is also a priority. If re-elected, I will mentor and encourage future candidates." Trichetti wrote that the last 3 years have been some of the most trying in the history of Midland ISD. He pointed to the COVID challenges and changes in leadership that have made improving the quality of education for the students of our community even more demanding. I am a lifelong advocate for quality public education. As a product of public school myself, and now sending my children to public school, Trishiti wrote. I have had children in MISD for the last 10 years and will continue to have a child in MISD until my youngest graduates in 2032. I want the best for all the students of Midland ISD. Trishiti brings his experience as a literacy advocate to the board. Not only is he in a leadership position with the Literacy Coalition of the Permian Basin, but he is the former director of libraries for Midland County. Under his watch, the county went about transforming the Centennial and downtown branches. He was also named the 2014 Texas Library Association Librarian of the Year. It is important that the district continues to work in close partnership with the MISD Education Foundation, local philanthropy, nonprofit and faith-based organizations, businesses, local governmental entities, and community members to help ensure that our transformation is successful for the benefit of students, parents, and community, he wrote. Trishiti wrote that he is a West Texas native, a graduate of Lubbock Coronado High School and Wayland Baptist University. He then received Master's of Library Science from the University of North Texas in Denton. His West Texas roots also include a short teaching stint in Brownfield ISD. In the Midland community, Trishiti has served on Basin PBS and Midland Airport boards. He is also a past recipient of the Rosalind Redfern Library Benefactor Award and Nonprofit Management Center Beacon Award for Outstanding Organizational Leadership. District 5 is one of three seats on the November ballot. The others are District 3 and District 6. This is the local page. This article is entitled Midland Community Theater. Current climate in Midland leads to changes with mummers, by Stuart Doreen. Midland Community Theater and its Summer Mummers volunteer group moves toward the next season of the summertime production with unresolved issues. Over the weekend, meetings were held at Midland Community Theater on Wadley Avenue and the VFW building north of Claydesta to talk about what's next for mummers, the process for volunteers, and bringing together two sides in the midst of turbulent times. Summer Mummers is a production that takes place for 14 weeks between Memorial Day and Labor Day at the Yucca Theater. The shows include a melodrama and the Olio, which is a set of song and dance skits. Those who attend the summer tradition often take part in the throwing of popcorn at people in their party and others attending the show. This behavior is encouraged by the performers who play in a show that changes yearly but has crude themes traditionally. Summer Mummers is a 28-show fundraiser that MCT officials said raises around $500,000 generally for the nonprofit's operating fund. Those who participate in Summer Mummers, from the box office to popcorn and alcohol sales, to the cast and production crew, generally volunteer their time and efforts, it was said Sunday. A source of the contention is that MCT has made changes in the leadership of Mummers to provide, quote, oversight and involvement, unquote. That included the installation of two members of the Midland Community Theater's Board of Governors as the chair and co-chair of Summer Mummers Committee. On Sunday, MCT Brass offered the following during a press conference. We just saw a need for the Board of Governors to step in and be more involved, according to Lisa Durgan, speaking on behalf of the Board of Governors and as the co-chair of the Summer Mummers Committee for MCT. We have been asked by other people in Summer Mummers to be more involved, and so we as a group decided it's time to step up and do that. There were no specifics offered at the MCT press event about why the need to step up. Summer Mummers volunteers didn't get many either at their Sunday event, leading to one person asking, "What did we do?" Three members of the Summer Mummers committee at the late afternoon meeting Sunday didn't have specifics either. Instead, they mentioned MCT officials couldn't speak for legal reasons. One thing that was passed along from the MCT board to volunteers through the committee members, Mark Cater, Wendy Kane, and Debbie Kelly at the VFW, was given the things MCT officials were told and given the current climate in Midland, things happening at Midland's private schools and such, there needed to be a stronger level of engagement between the Board of Governors and Summer Mummers. Cater, Kane, and Kelly also said every volunteer with MCT, not just those with Summer Mummers, will have to sign a code of conduct to participate in MCT events. The three, long-term Mummers volunteers in their own right, also said while changes have been made to the structure and MCT officials are calling for greater oversight, that the volunteer group remains the backbone of summer production. "I don't think Mummers would work right without you," Cater said. "I want to give you an opportunity. We want this to be the Mummers you know." What became clear during the volunteer meeting, which the chair and co-chair did not attend, was Cater, Kane, and Kelly encouraged their volunteer brethren to know that the show will go on, and it will be better if everyone was along for the ride. The three challenged their skeptical brothers and sisters to come to the April 10th kickoff for those interested in being part of Summer Mummers. "Give the group the opportunity to speak to you in person and learn how it is actually going to be," Kane said. "Give us one more chance." This is the Local Nation Obituaries page. This article is entitled, "Gas Prices Cool Down. Decline May Be Temporary," by Mella McEwen, Midland Reporter Telegram. Motorists may be getting a break at the gas pump as crude prices retreat from 14-year highs following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. "We have seen a little bit of a cool down from last week's spike to record highs," AAA Texas spokesman Daniel Armbruster told the Reporter Telegram in a telephone interview Monday. He said gasoline prices seem to be starting to mimic the decline in crude prices, which briefly fell below $100 a barrel before recouping some losses and closing at $103.01, down $6.32 a barrel. "Crude prices comprise half the cost of a gallon of gasoline," Armbruster pointed out, "with state and federal taxes, refining costs and profits and distribution and marketing. AAA Texas reported an average of $4.08 a gallon, which is 5 cents more than the average in Odessa." He also cautioned motorists not to expect a significant relief at the pump. "I think we're seeing a cooling off period, but I don't think we're done with high prices yet. We're not at the peak," he said. He listed refineries switching to summer blends of gasoline in the coming weeks in preparation for the summer driving season, as well as continued rising demand due to spring break and the upcoming summer driving season. "Although drivers may change their daily habits, leisure travel will continue due to pent-up demand," Armbruster said. One development that could lower crude prices is the lockdown of 7.5 million people in Shenzhen in China, the world's largest importer of crude, he said. While it's too early to know the impact of that lockdown, he said it could send oil prices lower by lowering demand. While two-thirds of Americans support the banning of Russian crude imports, despite the impact on prices, Armbruster noted that two-thirds also thought gasoline prices are too high. In another national poll, he said 59% of respondents said they would make changes to their driving habits in the face of high gasoline prices. "Driver behavior is the number one factor in how much gasoline is used," he said. To lower gasoline usage, he recommends drivers avoid quick acceleration, use cruise control when it's safe, avoid using the air conditioner when possible, and keep vehicles in top working order. This is the obituary column. Tuesday, March 15th. Frank Lee Bruno. Frank Lee Bruno transitioned from pain to heavenly perfection on March 3rd at his home in Georgetown at the age of 63. Lee loved and was loved here on earth by his wife Darlene Bruno of Georgetown. Also, his daughter Brittany Bruno with husband Austin Denson of Carrollton. His siblings Penny Bruno of Burnie, Randy Bruno, and sister-in-law Debbie of Fredericksburg. He is also survived by his mother Barbara Kingsland Bruno of Leander, his stepson Toby Brazil and wife Courtney, stepdaughter Melanie Bishop and husband Stephen, as well as seven beloved step-grandchildren. He was predeceased by his father Earl Randolph Bruno Sr., his aunt Dorothy Conklin, and his loyal dog Satchmo. Lucille Ann Funderburg Hayter. Lucille Ann Funderburg Hayter, 91, of Midland, passed away March 11th. A viewing will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday, March 14th, at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, March 15th, at First Baptist Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Lucille was born in Copper's Cove, Texas, on May 8, 1930. She married Jerry Ray Funderburg on January 4, 1949. They had four children, Larry Funderburg, Susan, Marcia Funderburg, Hankins, Susan Funderburg, Collins, Bobby, and Alan Funderburg, Deborah. Lucille also had nine grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. Lucille was preceded in death by her parents and siblings Weldon Horton, Sam Horton, Doris Green, and Geneva Turner. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to interim hospice. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Ruth N. Bird Henderson. Ruth N. Bird Henderson was born March 22, 1932, to Ruby Bird in Fort Smith, Arkansas. She was preceded in death by her mother, Ruby Bird, grandmother, Sophia Bird, grandfather, Otha Bird, and sister, Eddie J. Bray, ex-husband, B.T. Robertson, and husband, Lorenzo Henderson. She leaves to cherish her memory her brothers Barry Bagby of Grand Junction, Colorado, Paul Seville of Fort Smith, Arkansas, children Roy Lee Robertson of Hearn, Texas, Deborah Holland of Crowley, Texas, Cheryl E. Robertson of Midland, Anna L. Robertson of Midland, and Clifford D. Robinson of San Marcos. Eight grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, and a host of relatives and friends. There will be an evening wake Sunday, March 13th at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home from 6 to 7 p.m. Celebration of life services will be at the Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church Monday, March 14th at 10 a.m. and the burial at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Death notices. Mauro Rodriguez Flores. Mauro Rodriguez Flores, 92, of Midland, passed away on March 13th. Viewing will be Friday, March 18th, from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Graveside services will be held on Saturday, March 19th, at 11 a.m. at Glen Rest Cemetery in Big Lake. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Melvin Jerome Hill. Melvin Jerome Hill, 46, of Midland, passed away March 9th. Cremation services have been arranged by the family. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchestfh.com. Ronnie King. Ronnie King, 78, of Odessa, died March 11th in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. March 16th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Pastor Johnny Thomason is officiating.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, March 14th. OA continues to fight for public's right to know. City refuses to follow the law. Editor's note. This story was inadvertently garbled in Sunday's Odessa American. The OA regrets the error. The Odessa American is continuing its fight to force the city of Odessa to comply with laws designed to protect the public's right to free access to public records. Late Wednesday, attorneys for the Odessa American filed notice that they intend to appeal to the 11th Court of Appeals in Eastland, a recent lower court ruling in the newspaper's two-year-long legal battle that seeks to force the city of Odessa to produce public crime information in a timely fashion as required under Texas law. And the decision is being met by wholehearted support from organizations that champion freedom of information and government transparency. Quote, "The Odessa American is standing up for its readers and all Texans by pushing forward with this lawsuit to ensure government officials comply with the state's Public Information Act," said Kelly Shannon, executive director of the Freedom of Information Foundation of Texas. Quote, "Public records should be provided to requesters promptly and without delay. That's what the law requires," end quote. The city of Odessa has a history of abuse in open meetings and open records laws. A 2017 landmark settlement between the OA and the city forced the city of Odessa to acknowledge violating open meetings laws and requires the municipality to keep audio recordings of all city council executive sessions. Those recordings could then be reviewed by a judge if a member of the public suspects the city council held an illegal closed-door executive session. The city of Odessa is the only municipality in Texas required to record executive sessions. Other municipalities in Texas may either record executive sessions or simply take notes, but the Odessa City Council lost that option in 2017. OA publisher Patrick Kenty noted that the current city attorney was part of the municipality's legal team that signed the 2017 judgment. Quote, "I think the city has resented that condition placed upon them ever since," Kenty said. "But they brought that on themselves. They got what they deserved because they violated the law so flagrantly. And we, the public, had no other way to hold them accountable other than requiring them to record those closed sessions." Quote, "It is all about ways of enforcing our laws, and this latest case is no different. They have shown they violated the law, and now we need a judgment that provides a greater degree of forcing the city to obey the law," end quote. The most recent lawsuit between the city and the OA could have ended more than a week ago if the city would have agreed to sign a consent judgment in this case, simply obligating the city to comply with the law they claim they are following. That agreement, proposed by the OA, simply stated that the city would agree to abide by Texas open records laws, and it even cited the specific portions of the law. In exchange, the newspaper agreed to not pursue either an appeal of the costly lawsuit or reimbursement of its legal fees. The city of Odessa has spent more than $164,000 in attorney fees since the lawsuit was filed. The agreement would have ended the city spending tax dollars on outside attorneys to help defend the municipality in the lawsuit. Quote, "This refusal tells the public all it needs to know about the city's intentions going forward and shows why the city brought this lawsuit on itself," said John Bussian, the OA's attorney and a nationally recognized expert in First Amendment and open records, open meetings laws. The OA's appeal comes after visiting State District Court Judge Rodney Satterwhite dismissed the OA's lawsuit last month, siding with the city, which argued that since they ultimately turned over the disputed documents, the matter was moot. But Canty asserted that argument by the city is off base. The city still violated the law, he said, and legal steps must be taken to ensure they do not do so again. Quote, their logic makes no sense, Canty said. It's like if someone were to rob a bank and then return the money a month later. I don't think the authorities would agree if the robber were to say, well, I returned the money, so the robbery never happened. End quote. The Odessa American filed its open records lawsuit in June 2020, arguing the city has violated the Texas Freedom of Information Act by delaying and or redacting police records and other documents related to criminal justice matters, documents that have always been readily available to the public throughout the state. Canty said, regardless of the latest ruling, he believes the case law is firmly on the side of the newspaper and the public. Quote, if this ruling stands, it makes a critical part of Texas open record laws worthless to not just the news media, but every citizen in the state of Texas, he said. It would mean any governmental agency could stonewall and censor information that has always been public to everyone, end quote. Shannon agreed, quote, all citizens have a right to ask questions and know how their government is operating, she said. Timely access to public information goes hand in hand with exercising First Amendment rights and participating in our democracy. That's true for journalists and every member of the community who is keeping a watch on public officials, end quote. On January 31st, attorneys on both sides spent 2 hours in the 161st State District Court in Odessa arguing over the matter, with both sides asking for the judge to render a summary judgment rather than allowing the case to proceed to a jury trial in the future. The newspaper's attorneys, including Bussian and Jeff Nobles, told Satterwhite that under Texas law, the city has a duty to immediately make available to the public basic crime information, such as the names of suspects and witnesses, crime locations, and the nature of the crime. They said the city only had the right to delay information if they were seeking advice from the Texas Attorney General's office, and that information was beyond basic. Nobles noted the city has delayed releasing basic information on numerous occasions. Following the 2019 Odessa mass shooting, the city waited 116 days to release basic information, and it waited 92 days to release basic information in another unrelated case involving a double homicide. The second case is particularly of note because it happened at a local car wash just months after the mass shooting. Rumor-mongering on social media exploded the day of the double homicide, with speculation flying that the incident was another mass shooting. Quote, in that case, a level of public hysteria erupted that a local news organization could have headed off had we been given basic information about the incident in a timely manner so that we could share it with the public, Canty said. Continuing the quote, it was a perfect example of how, when public officials stand in the way of the public's right to know, it can have very negative consequences, end quote. During the January 31st hearing, Hal Brockett Jr., who represents the city of Odessa, told the judge the city did not violate the law because the city simply has an obligation to reply as soon as possible under the circumstances. He and attorney Keith Stretcher further argued all the information requested by the newspaper had been turned over, rendering the entire case moot. Satterwhite agreed with the city's attorneys, and he also ruled the city of Odessa does not have to pay the newspaper's attorney's fees. Some elected officials have touted this as victory for the city and have even gone so far as to indicate it proves, quote, the city did nothing wrong, end quote. However, Canty was quick to point out the judge never said anything of the sort. Again, Satterwhite dismissed the lawsuit because he felt the issue was moot. He did not address whether the city was wrong for having initially delayed release of the public information, which was heavily redacted of basic information to which the public is entitled, Canty said. And Nobles maintains that it doesn't matter that the city eventually provided the information. He believes the judge needed to legally recognize the difference between basic information that might be released immediately and other sorts of information that can be released at a later time. Without that ruling, he said, the city of Odessa can and will continue to provide information on their timeline. The city has also cast itself in the role of protector throughout the lawsuit, claiming the OA wanted to publish the names of sexual assault victims and child victims. Like most news organizations, the OA does not print that information. Quote, their PR campaign to attempt to twist the reality of the dispute is absurd, Canty said. They are claiming to be the protector of the very people to whom they are denying ready access to public information, not just the news media. This affects everyone. What they don't understand is that public records belong to all of us. The governmental agency is merely the custodian of that information, but it is our information, and only in very specific circumstances do they have the right to withhold certain types of information. Quote, this is a classic case of the tail wagging the dog, and the public needs to bear in mind that the OA has been fighting to get the city to abide by Texas public transparency laws through two lawsuits during the past 5 years, end quote. OA lawsuit timeline. 2017. To remedy violations of Texas open government law, a landmark judgment against the city was entered, with the city's consent, in a lawsuit filed by the OA. The consent judgment requires Odessa City Council to record every executive session. They are the only municipality in Texas required to do so. 2020. The OA filed a petition for mandamus, as specified by the Texas Public Information Act, in early 2020, over the city's withholding of basic public crime records following the mass shooting in Odessa a few months earlier, delaying release of basic crime information until the city delivered the basic information requested by the OA to the Texas Attorney General's office and received a formal opinion from the AG on the information withheld. The city initially engaged outside counsel from Austin, Bill Cobb, to oppose the OA's TPIA suit by filing a plea to the jurisdiction, a motion to join State of Texas as a third-party defendant, a motion to transfer the case to Travis County, and a wave of discovery requests to the OA, all designed to delay disposition of the OA's suit. October 2020. After COVID-driven delays in scheduling a hearing on the pending motions, a hearing was finally held before visiting State District Judge Rodney Satterwhite, at which time he denied the city's plea to the jurisdiction. That triggered an appeal by the city to the Intermediate 11th Court of Appeals in Eastland and automatically stayed the litigation pending review by the Eastland Court. May 2021. A unanimous Eastland Court of Appeals affirmed Judge Satterwhite's denial of the city's plea to the jurisdiction, reciting the TPIA correctly as applied to the undisputable facts pled by the OA. On the return of the case to Judge Rodney Satterwhite's court, the city hired new outside counsel and promptly filed another plea to the jurisdiction and 400-plus pages of record material that shows the TPIA violations alleged by the OA. The city argued essentially that while there were chronic delays in releasing the records, while repeatedly having the AG vet requests for even basic crime information, the city eventually produced the records and rendered moot the OA's suit for violation of the TPIA and its claim for recovery of legal expenses under the Act. January 2022. The OA added record evidence in support of the summary judgment motion and in opposition to the city's motions showing that TPIA violations continue and occurred as recently as June 2021. February 2022. Judge Satterwhite denied the OA's request to have the court find the city in violation of Texas open government law. After Judge Satterwhite ruled against the OA in an attempt to resolve the lawsuit without further expense to the taxpayers and the OA presented the city with a judgment, like the 2017 judgment to which the city consented, that would simply obligate the city to comply with the Texas Public Information Act open government law in the future. March 2022, the city refused to consent to entry of the judgment, forcing the OA to appeal Judge Satterwhite's ruling to the Intermediate State Court of Appeals in Eastland. March 9, 2022, OA files an appeal with the Eastland Court of Appeals. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. The Crisis Center of West Texas is in need of new women's, men's, and kids' underwear and women's and kids' socks, no men's socks. Donations may be dropped off from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday or from 8 a.m. to noon on Friday at the center at 910 South Grant Avenue, Number B. Monetary donations may be made at tinyurl.com/2p8cnbaj. For more information, call 432-333-2527. Medical Center Hospital is in need of volunteers for its adult volunteer program. Assignments vary. To learn more, call 432-640-2249 or visit mchodessa.com. Faith Fellowship Lutheran Church at 1603 North Grandview Avenue has scheduled Lenten midweek lunch and services from noon to 1 p.m. Wednesdays through April 6th. For more information, call 432-362-2549 or email office@faithfellowshipodessa.org. Hector County Coliseum, 4201 Andrews Highway, has scheduled the Wright's Amusement Carnival Thursday through March 27th. Carnival bands are $30. For times or more information, call 432-366-3541. Medical Center Health System has scheduled Share a Pint Blood Drive from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Thursday at the main admitting entrance. Sign up online at bloodhero.com. For questions, contact Susan Thornton at 432-640-2347 or email sthornton@echd.org. The Ellen Noel Art Museum at 4909 East University Boulevard has scheduled National Quilt Month film series at 6 p.m. Thursdays. Thursday, Paducah, Kentucky Quilt Fever. March 24th, Bisa Butler Quilt Portraits, G's Bend Quilters. March 31st, Ken Burns Quilt Collection. There will be short videos of famous quilt artists, quilt events, and quilt collections. Admission is free. For more information, visit noelartmuseum.org. The Odessa Police Department is currently taking applications for its next Citizens Police Academy. Application deadline is Friday. Classes will begin on March 31st. There is no registration fee, and the Odessa Police Department will provide all classroom materials. For application or more information, visit odessa-tx.gov. Knights of Columbus number 3203 and Daughters of Mary has scheduled Fish Fridays fundraiser from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. each Friday during Lent, except for Good Friday on March 25th at St. Mary's Catholic Church Cafeteria, 618 East 18th Street. Plates are $12 each. For more information, call 432-332-5334. Knights of Columbus 17679 has scheduled a fish fry and food drive from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Friday and April 1st at Holy Redeemer Parish Hall at 2633 Conover Avenue. The menu will include fried fish, coleslaw, hush puppies, cornbread, dessert, and drink. Plates are $12, or support the House of Mercy, $10 a plate, when two non-perishable items are donated. Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Tuesday, March 15th. Falcon Giving Day coming up. Online event benefits students. Featuring swag and matching funds, University of Texas Permian Basin's Falcon Giving Day is coming up April 13th. Falcon Giving Day is a 24-hour campaign that aims to inspire Falcons everywhere to come together, show pride for UTPB, and provide essential funding to support current and future students, the UTPB website said. Kimberly Luna is the annual giving coordinator, and Cameron Wesson is the associate annual giving coordinator. Donations go to scholarships, the food pantry, and the student emergency fund, for example. Quote, "It's all online giving," Luna said. The website to visit is www.utpb.edu/givingday, Wesson said. Quote, "Donors can go on that website. There's a section where they can fill out the amount they want to give, and they can choose where they want their money to go. If they wanted to go to the Student Emergency Fund, or if they wanted to go towards a certain scholarship, our food pantry, they can choose wherever it goes," Luna said. "If they are alumni, they graduated from one of our colleges, they can use their donation for the College of Business or Biology, wherever they want it to go," end quote. Luna said the funds go towards students' interests. An example is the Student Emergency Fund. Quote, "If there's a reason why a student can't continue their education, if there's a hindrance in their personal life, anything like that, they can't afford the gas to get to the university, then that's where we step in. They can apply for the Student Emergency Fund, and we can help them with that. That way, they can continue their education and not have to worry about how am I going to get there, how am I going to pay for gas, things like that," Luna said. Contributors can choose to give to scholarship funds. Quote, "Everything is donor's choice. With our scholarships, we have a general scholarship fund where there are no specific criteria to get that scholarship. Everybody can apply. It's open to everyone. Then, of course, we have some of our scholarships that are directed towards students of business or nursing where they have to be in that program to get the scholarship. But we have a lot of scholarship opportunities at the university, and we want to help fund those so we can continue helping students get an education without having to worry about funding," Luna added. This is the third year for Falcon Giving Day. Quote, "Last year, We had a total of 271 donors, and we got a total of about $270,000, so that really helped a lot of students. This year, we want to raise that and have 300 donors. That's our goal, Luna said. Quote, we're not going to have a monetary goal. We want to have a donor goal because we want to get the community involved. We want to get alumni involved, even if it's $5 or $5,000. Whatever an individual can give, we'd be happy to accept that. We just want to get that involvement, she added. Luna said there will be giveaways throughout the day for donations. Luna said it's also a way to raise awareness among students that this is something the university does annually, so when they graduate and they are able, they will know about Falcon Giving Day and be more inclined to contribute. Plus, they'll have an idea of where the funds are going because many students have benefited from these scholarships, Luna said. Wesson said there will be opportunities that day for students to sign up to volunteer in the community. Quote, we're going to ask different organizations in the community to come out and have a sign-up sheet, so that way the students can give back to the community. We're just going to have them come in and sign up for hours, different organizations, Luna said. It's also a chance for students to network, which could lead to internships, she added. Falcon Giving Day has had a big response from the start. Quote, the first year, I believe, was the first year when COVID hit. They still went on with having it because it was planned and everything. They had a really good response that year, and it just continued to grow since then. Last year, we were able to help more than 1,100 students with our Falcon Giving Day alone, Luna said. New ultrasound gives better baby view. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. With its new state-of-the-art ultrasound systems, Odessa Regional Medical Center's perinatal centers in Odessa and Midland got an upgrade aimed at providing a sense of security to expectant moms. Donna Kelly, Director of Perinatal Services, said the hospital purchased 7 new Philips EPIQ Elite ultrasound systems. There are 4 sonogram rooms in Odessa and 3 in Midland, so Kelly said every sonogram room they have has new equipment in it. Quote, maternal fetal medicine as a whole, what we do is we see high-risk pregnancies. So if mamas have problems like diabetes, hypertension, or cardiac issues, or if they have twins or triplets, then we'll see them for that. But there are times that babies have problems, like they may have genetic risk, or their OB doctor finds something on a sono that doesn't look right. We have a lot of our physicians who will send us their 20-week scans. That means just normal pregnancy, but just doing a really good look at anatomy at 20 weeks gestation, Kelly said. Continuing the quote, we will look to make sure that heart flows are good, all the anatomy structures are proper, baby's growth is appropriate, placenta is functioning well. So in order to know how babies are doing, we have to be able to view those tiny structures. You have to realize that there are times we're looking at babies when they're no bigger than a big lima bean, Kelly said. She said they are looking at a heart and other structures that are teeny, teeny, tiny. Quote, to be able to penetrate through mama's tummy and be able to view the heart and the kidneys of something that is 11 weeks gestation, 15 weeks gestation, that's no bigger than an inch, 2 inches. It requires a very high-quality machine to be able to get in there and look, Kelly said. She noted that the machines have the capacity to track blood flow through the heart, the kidneys, and the brain, for example. Quote, this machine will let us really evaluate these teeny tiny fetuses very early in the pregnancy and be able to determine early whether we have a problem here. If we can diagnose problems early, there are fetal centers that we can refer a patient to that can do surgery to fix these issues, Kelly said. She added that this gives mothers added assurance that if they see something, they can move fast to get it corrected. She said there are a lot of high-risk pregnancies in the area. They see a lot of women with gestational diabetes, hypertension, mothers that are expecting twins and triplets, and some genetic issues that run through family lines, among other issues. They can now see issues at 12 weeks that didn't get noticed previously until 24 weeks. Quote, and it makes a big difference on what you can do to be proactive, and it will make a big difference to those moms. For most of our pregnancies, thank goodness, most of them are fine. And we can see them, and we can send them on their way and reassure them that everything is good. And for every mom in the world, that's what they want to hear, Kelly said. Quote, but for those moms who have a baby that everything isn't quite perfect, we have the best chance there is to identify it early and be able to do something about it and send them to the very best. We have some contacts in Houston, Dallas, and Austin. We send them where we know they're going to get the very best. Where would we want our daughters and our wives treated? She added. Kelly said when she started as a labor and delivery nurse in 1994, she worked with their first perinatologist. Quote, I watched this area grow and develop. I've seen the impact. I've seen babies that are having birthdays that would not have had birthdays if we hadn't been here. And I see these kids now, the patients that I saw are now having babies. So not only would they not be here, but these babies they're having wouldn't be here, so it makes me quite proud, Kelly said. Continuing the quote, I'm very passionate about giving the very best level of care that we can to our community and the difference that it makes, she added. She added that they were able to diagnose a very uncommon heart anomaly in a baby within 2 weeks of getting this equipment. Kelly said they wouldn't have been able to diagnose the condition prior. Ultrasound technician Mackenzie Cook said she thinks the machines are fantastic. Quote, they've done really, really well. We have the new capabilities of really advanced color flow, Doppler, and 3D, 4D. We have really advanced 2D. We have so many more capabilities as far as calculations, measurements, all sorts of things that are really high-tech and advanced, Cook said. It took a while to get used to, end quote. Cook added that she feels blessed to be able to work on the new machines. Quote, I feel like I can give top-of-the-line care, Cook said. She added that it has made her job easier. Quote, the image quality is really improved a lot on a lot of our patients and our patient population. I really feel like I can improve, and it's given us the drive to try and advance our image quality as well. We've been working on adding new images as far as the heart, and these machines help us do that every time, Cook said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.